time for this morning's presentation, and our speaker is Joanne Green. Joanne has been a Unitarian for almost 55 years. Joanne's parents had moved to Calgary in 1950, and the city was a very conservative town. Like many families, Joanne's parents belonged to the United Church. However, her mother reached a point where she just couldn't teach Sunday school at the United Church any longer. Fortunately, friends pointed them in a different direction, and her parents joined the Unitarian Church of Calgary when Joanne was 8 years old. Joanne says that one of the most important parts of Unitarian life as a teenager was liberal religious youth. The group was more than accepting of differences. They encouraged the teenagers to think for themselves. In the late 60s, there were so many political changes to think about and act upon. It was a heady time for Unitarians. Anti-Vietnam War protests, invasions in Czechoslovakia, and pushing for women's rights provided the backdrop to life in the 60s. Joanne is the current president of the Unitarian Fellowship.
Well, good morning. Again, to those of you who I've already said good morning, and thank you for asking me to speak once again. Yeah, I can see the glasses and the paper. Okay. I would also like to extend my thanks to Jane Knox and the Sunday Service Committee for rearranging schedules in February because I just didn't have enough time then. So today I'm talking about Kurt Vonnegut. I'll confine my talk primarily to the early years of his life and some discussion of how his writing reflected Unitarian principles. Vonnegut is listed as Unitarian Universalist on the famous Unitarian Universalists list from a book called 100 Questions That Non-Members Ask About Unitarian Universalism. I'm not sure why we feel the need to claim people, famous people, as Unitarians. Perhaps we think it helps others understand UUs. The only authorized biography I found was written by Charles J. Shields and published in 2011. The author was able to interview Vonnegut only a few times in 2006 and had to complete his research after Vonnegut died in 2007. I think he had 3 interviews or something. There were 200 letters made available to the author, but at the request of Vonnegut's second wife, the letters could not be quoted directly. Other sources I reference include a sermon by Wesley Hromadko, a talk presented to the Dorothea Dix Unitarian Congregation, and another talk by Reverend Anthony McCarr, senior minister of the UU Congregation of Atlanta, Georgia. That's a mouthful. I've been an admirer of Vonnegut's stories for most of my life, starting in the mid-60s in the Calgary Unitarian Youth Group. We all read Kurt Vonnegut books, listened to Judy Collins and Leonard Cohen, and were terribly earnest about change. Vonnegut was something of a hero to me. His books were critical of government and big corporations, and he wrote stories that read a bit like science fiction, which is one of my favorite genres. The most famous of Vonnegut's books, Slaughterhouse-Five, was published in 1969 when I was just 18. That year coincided with Vietnam War protests, riots on campuses, and political unrest everywhere in Canada and the U.S. When I first read the book, I knew Vonnegut had been a prisoner of war and survived the bombing of Dresden, but I really didn't appreciate the true horrors of war. Today, we talk about PTSD and recognize the difficulties experienced by returning vets. But in 1945, that just wasn't the case. His experiences would give him nightmares for a long time. Kurt Vonnegut's personal connection to UUs began at birth on November 11, 1922. In the Midwestern U.S., his parents and grandparents were Unitarians and known as free thinkers in Indianapolis. His family was also third-generation German-American. Apparently, free thinking, being known as a free thinker also went along with lack of parenting for some reason. There is little reference in the biography to events at Unitarian churches. Most information about his connections to UUs came from internet sources. Vonnegut's grandfather and father were architects, and his grandfather designed a Unitarian church in their hometown of Indianapolis. In an interview in Free Inquiry magazine, Kurt once said his family had been skeptical of organized religion for at least four generations. Kurt was the youngest of three children and was alternately picked on or ignored by siblings and parents, especially his older brother Bernard. Once, his parents took Vonnegut's older siblings to Europe by ship and left him at home with his aunt and uncle. He was only 2 years old. At other times, Kurt was left with the housekeeper who filled the role of mother better than his biological mother. Even at the age of 86, Vonnegut blamed his father, mother, and eldest brother for wounds inflicted more than 75 years before. Charles Shields, the biographer, wrote that, "By the time we said goodbye on his doorstep, my impression was that Kurt Vonnegut, humanist and champion of families in his novels, was a lonely, disenchanted man. The family's lifestyle was certainly an eclectic mix of old money, high society events, lack of discipline in financial affairs, and distant parenting. Vonnegut attended a public school for most of his school years, while his older siblings attended private schools. Once the depression of the 1930s arrived, there was no more money for private schools, and all of the children went to public schools. Apparently, high school was an enjoyable experience for Vonnegut, and he started his writing career there on the high school paper. However, the family fortunes declined continuously, with his parents selling off his mother's inheritance and possessions steadily. This fall from society was very difficult for his mother, and she steadily became more and more depressed. She turned on her husband, criticizing his earning potential and raging at his inadequacies. Edith Vonnegut eventually committed suicide on Mother's Day in 1944, and Vonnegut's father retreated even further from the family. He had a lot of ugly events in his life. I'm just going to backtrack a little in time now. In 1940, Kurt applied at several universities. Attendance at Cornell, rather than Harvard, was a choice recommended by his brother, Bernard. He didn't think Kurt would do well at Harvard, another reason Vonnegut resented his brother. While at Cornell, where Vonnegut majored in chemistry and biology, he also wrote for the Cornell Daily Sun. His columns were humorous and satirical, but he had a serious side too. At one point, he told the editor of another Cornell University paper that their cartoons seemed anti-Semitic, and he urged them to tone down the cartoons. The editor, who later became a friend and book editor, complied. Vonnegut was also in ROTC while at Cornell. This was mandatory. And at this point, he was an isolationist politically, even writing articles in support of the Lindberghs. His German-American background was an influence on his position as an anti-interventionist. Of course, the bombing of Pearl Harbor changed a lot of minds, though. In 1943, Vonnegut enlisted in the Army as a private. His father thought he should have been an officer, having been in ROTC, and was disgusted with his choice. And a few months after his mother's death, Vonnegut was sent overseas. His new division was sent to take the place of an experienced division, and very quickly, Vonnegut's unit was sent on a scouting mission. Their unit was soon surrounded by Germans and the men taken prisoner during the Battle of the Bulge. After forced marches, sleeping in the snow at night, and watching their fellow soldiers fall and die from exhaustion, the prisoners were taken to Dresden in cattle cars. At one point, the train was bombed by the Allies. In Dresden, they were given work in a vitamin factory. And in February 1945, Dresden was firebombed by the Allies. Only 7 of the original prisoners survived by taking shelter in a meat storage locker below a slaughterhouse. In a quote from a paper by Reverend Makar, a description of the next few days goes like this, and it's really awful. After he was saved, he and the other POWs were forced to work as corpse miners, breaking into shelters and cellars where 135,000 Hansels and Gretels had been baked like gingerbread men. Later, when he returned home to the States, he discovered there was little to nothing in the news about what had happened in Dresden, the human tragedy there that he had lived through. It taught him to distrust government, radicalized him thoroughly, a reason for why he was one of the preeminent protesters against Vietnam. Why he was so thoroughly despised the foreign policy of Washington. I think maybe there's a mistake here of George W. Bush. The only difference between Bush and Hitler is that Hitler was elected. That's really confusing. Bush was elected. Sorry about that. These experiences later led to Vonnegut's most important novel, Slaughterhouse-Five. After returning from Europe, Vonnegut proposed to his longtime friend Jane Marie Cox, and they were married on September 14, 1945. They honeymooned at Lake Maxinkookie, Indiana, where the family spent summers. Jane was a huge supporter of Kurt's writing and worked very hard to give him the space to write and be successful. Her background was literature, and together they both enrolled at the University of Chicago, Kurt in anthropology and Jane as a graduate student with courses in history, economics, political science, and anthropology. Her intellect was valuable to Vonnegut, as she was often his first reader. Sadly, neither of them finished their degrees, as children and a need for an income interrupted their studies. Much of Vonnegut's early writing included stories for Reader's Digest and other popular magazines. He was rarely published in Harper's or other serious magazines. His writing was more often directed at earning money to pay the bills. In 1948 or so, he took a job as a publicist at General Electric, where his brother was a brilliant scientist. According to Charles Shields, General Electric's Schenectady Works was nicknamed the House of Magic. Inside the gates, 30,000 employees worked in 240 buildings on a 600-acre campus. I mean, literally a city of people. The first year or two actually went fairly well, with plenty of articles providing great publicity for the company and good pay for Vonnegut. For a time, he saw GE as improving life, making electricity, keeping food from rotting, washing clothes, or lighting up rooms. While working full-time, Vonnegut was also writing continuously at home. He wrote each morning and evening as well as weekends at a table just set up in a little hallway off the living room. Jane kept the home life going as she would throughout their married life, despite her own mental health problems. One day, while at work at GE, and this is where things started shifting for him, Kurt watched a computer-programmed lathe cutting steel blades. No machinists were involved. Charles Shields wrote that, for Vonnegut, craftsmanship was a mature talent, learned and passed through generations, and here was a device operating tirelessly, doing what took a person a lifetime to learn. To have a little clicking box make all the decisions wasn't a vicious thing to do, but it was too bad for the human beings who got their dignity from their jobs. So was born the idea for Player Piano. That was his first published book. By mid-1950, Vonnegut and his wife, Jane, determined he should write full-time, and he left GE. They were probably about ready to suggest he leave anyway. By the summer of 1951, they moved to Cape Cod for the summer. There, Vonnegut met Norman Mailer along with many other writers and artists. It was a wonderful summer, the family of five moved to Cape Cod permanently, buying a big old house in Barnstable. However, this community wasn't like the artists' community they first lived in. In fact, it was quite isolated, and the family was constantly short of money. The publishing of his first novel didn't take place until 1952, and when the money arrived, they had a big party. No repairs to the big old house. A review of Player Piano stated that the book embeds and foreshadows themes which are to be parsed and dramatized by academians for centuries to come. His future society is mechanistic and cruel, indifferent to human consequence, almost in a state of merriment as human wreckage accumulates. The novel embodies all of Vonnegut's concerns and what he takes to be the great dilemma of the technologically overpowered century. The spiritual needs of the population in no way serve the economies of technology and post-technology. Vonnegut overlies this grotesque comedy over tragedy, disguising his novel in the trappings of goofiness. Some of the characters in his novel were called the Reeks and the Wrecks, and eventually one of the engineers revolts. The theme from Player Piano resonated strongly with me and also was covered in Hromatko's talk. One of Vonnegut's main ideas is human dignity. Human dignity has been central to Unitarian Universalists since the time of Channing. When Vonnegut spoke at Cambridge Unitarian Church, he recalled Channing's great idea of human dignity. Considering the unusual and bizarre characters in some of the novels, we might think dignity is the last thing Vonnegut would value. Human dignity means, however, that people have value as people, no matter who they are. The Vonnegut family continued to live for several years in a hand-to-mouth fashion, with Vonnegut trying to make a living just from his writing. An inheritance from his father helped them keep going. His relationship with his sister, Alice, was by this time much different from their youth. He revered Alice and indicated that Alice was the person I had always written for. She was the secret of whatever artistic unity I had achieved. She was the secret of my technique. However, by 1958, Alice's health was declining quickly from cancer, and Kurt's brother-in-law was running through Alice's inheritance. While Alice was in the hospital, her husband was one day on his way to work with a surefire project when the train went off the Newark Bridge. Alice and her husband both died within a day of each other. Suddenly, Jane and Kurt became parents to four more boys, ranging in age from 2 to 17. So now there are 7 kids in this big old house, and only the money from a writer coming in. However, it was really Jane that took on the parenting. Vonnegut would frequently disappear when difficult choices had to be made. He was also becoming known as a grouch and an angry man. He would often come roaring out of his study, yelling at the kids to stop making so much noise, in a real rage. As a result, the children stayed out of his way as much as possible. Ha, I woke you up. It wasn't all bad, though. There were expeditions through the marsh that everyone looked forward to each year. During much of his 30s and 40s, Vonnegut often felt he was overlooked by many as a serious writer because of the science fiction feel to his books. He was bitter that he wasn't taken seriously and complained, "I wasn't even getting reviewed. Esquire published a list of the American literary world, and it guaranteed that every living author of the slightest merit was on there somewhere. I wasn't on their list, and it made me feel subhuman." However, as the years went on, Vonnegut acquired a loyal following, especially among Unitarian congregations and the radical left. In the talk by Wesley Hromatko, he said, Vonnegut's writing is hard to classify, and it sometimes ends up with science fiction. It helps to realize, however, that Vonnegut, like Jonathan Swift, who wrote Gulliver's Travels, is a satirist. The author even wrote a preface for a new edition of Gulliver. Vonnegut's first book, Player Piano, is a dystopia like Brave New World, or 1984. Cat's Cradle spoofs the doomsday novels such as On the Beach. It, like The Sirens of Titan, also deals with religion. Slaughterhouse-Five is a war novel. It is a novel against war, as was Joseph Heller's Catch-22. Apparently they knew each other and were good friends. In the book Palm Sunday, Hromatko says, Vonnegut claims to be a Christ-worshipping agnostic. Vonnegut's only true children's book tells the story of how Jesus was born as a human baby. As Vonnegut might say, and so it goes. That was one of his favorite sayings. By 1967, Vonnegut had finally completed research for his book, Slaughterhouse-Five. It took him 22 years to figure out how to tell the story. He traveled to Dresden with his friend Bernie O'Hare, who had survived the bombing with Kurt. His new book appeared first in a magazine called Ramparts, and I imagine some people here are familiar with that magazine. Essays by Noam Chomsky, Cesar Chavez, Tom Hayden, and Angela Davis, to name a few, put radical left values on people's coffee tables. Vonnegut's fame increased exponentially after the publication of Slaughterhouse-Five, and many readers assumed his ideas were in sympathy with the radical left, just as Makar thought. However, that wasn't always the case. People expected him to be a radical because of his writing, but according to Shields, Vonnegut was really a traditionalist and yearned for a return to a simpler time. Once the book Slaughterhouse-Five was published, Vonnegut was often asked to speak at various public events, Unitarian and otherwise. One such event was a meeting of the American Association of Physics Teachers, where he said that ethical humanistic physicists would watch people, listen to them, and would decline to work on weapons. Vonnegut was now launched on his new persona of a moralizing writer. He was even invited to go to Biafra, and while there, narrowly escaped the country with the last foreigners to leave. Once again, he was in the midst of bombing and witness to utter devastation. Reverend Makar also wrote that when Vonnegut delivered the Ware Lecture at the Unitarian Universalist General Assembly in 1984, he said, in order not to seem a spiritual quadriplegic to strangers trying to get a fix on me, I sometimes say I'm a Unitarian Universalist. So that denomination claims me as one of their own. Makar went on to say, we do that shamelessly this morning, claim Kurt Vonnegut as one of our own, as we explore his unique humanist vision and see how it might speak to the vision each of us brings to the world. In a talk given at Dorothea Dix Unitarian Church, and I couldn't find the presenter's name, that person is quoted as saying, is there any hope for humanity? Vonnegut gives us some straws to grasp onto. In The Sirens of Titan, he says, take care of people, and God Almighty will take care of himself. In God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater, Vonnegut comes closest to giving a message of hope. Elliot Rosewater, the character, whose family is trying to have him committed for giving back the family fortune to the people who he felt it rightfully belonged, is asked to conduct the baptism of a neighbor's twins. When asked what he will say, he responds, hello, babies. Welcome to Earth. It's hot in the summer and cold in the winter. It's round and wet and crowded. At the outside, babies, you've got about 100 years here. There's only one rule that I know of, babies. God damn it, you've got to be kind. When theology, Makar says of Vonnegut, start with something called Bocanonism. This is another one I really liked. Some of you may be familiar with the awesome UU adult religious education curriculum called Building Your Own Theology. That's exactly what Kurt Vonnegut did in all his books, but most especially in Cat's Cradle, where he fleshes out an entire new religion called Bocanonism. Wikipedia gives us a wicked good and wicked fast summary. Bocanonism is based on the concept of FOMA, which are defined as harmless untruths. A foundation of Bocanonism is that the religion, including its text, is formed entirely of lies. However, one who believes and adheres to these lies will have peace of mind and perhaps live a good life. The primary tenet of Bocanonism is to live by the FOMA that make you brave and kind and healthy and happy. It's not so bad. A webpage about the religion of celebrities indicated Kurt Vonnegut Jr. regularly states in interviews that his religion is humanism. He calls it his ancestral religion and also the religion by which he is actively a part and believes in. Vonnegut proudly served as the honorary president of the American Humanist Association. So although Vonnegut is claimed as a Unitarian, he himself often said otherwise. But does it really matter? I don't think so. What matters is the human desire for kindness, just as Kurt Vonnegut wrote. There is no question he was a flawed human being, but I intend to remember him for his ideas. I think he was one of the important authors of the 20th century. Thank you. Now, Andrew is going to say, well, there isn't a lot of time left, though, so I don't know if we want to have just a couple of comments. Has anybody got comments or questions?
Joanne, I just wanted to ask if you had any kind of feeling as you were going through the research that you did, that he may not have made that magazine list for his left-wing ideas, and also it sounds like he might have come across as an atheist to people. Do you think there was an element of leaving him off deliberately?
I suspect it would have been deliberate. He annoyed a lot of people with his approach to editors and his approach to literary agents and other magazines and other writers. He was really pretty rude to a lot of them. So who knows? It could have been to do with his personality and nothing to do with his writing at all. Although a lot of his earlier books were published by Dell and they had these really lurid sex kitten covers, you know, in purple and orange, and he just wasn't taken seriously by a lot of people.
Okay.
I just wanted to say I really liked the way you gave such a personal history, you know, background. So we had a really good context for why he might have written what he did. And I had his Slaughterhouse-Five was one of the books I had in my grade 12 as the one I was teaching when I was teaching grade 12, for people to choose if they wanted.
The movie was really quite moving as well. I thought anyway. But okay, well, thank you very much, folks.